From our newsroom in London, this is The Standard. This edition is a preview of the latest episode of Brave New World, a podcast where Evgeny Lebedev speaks to leading experts about the latest trends in modern medicine and how to maximise health and longevity. To hear the whole interview and listen to previous episodes, search Brave New World Evening Standard on your podcast provider.
Welcome back to Brave New World. I'm your host, Evgeny Lebedev, and for this special episode, we're looking at tech, social media, and its impact on the child and adolescent brain. Joining me is a very special guest, Jonathan Haidt, who's a Thomas Cooley Professor of Ethical Leadership at the Stern School of Business at NYU.
My mother's mother was born in Bryansk in Russia. You know, all the others were from Poland and Belarus, you know, Jewish, the typical American Jewish story. But my grandmother spoke Russian.
Jonathan is a social psychologist and the author of several books, including The Righteous Mind, which explores why good people end up divided by politics and religion, and The Coddling of the American Mind, co-written with the First Amendment lawyer, Greg Lukianoff. It's the first time I've read and heard someone explain the decay that's happening in the English-speaking Western society in such a level-headed and well-researched and clear and succinct way, because usually it's done from the perspective of the very things that you talk about, from very polarizing.
A partisan, yes, political view, yeah.
Jonathan's latest book, The Anxious Generation, is out now. In it, he argues that we have created an anxious generation of children by overcoddling and protecting them in real life, and not, in his words, leaving them enough room for unsupervised play, while also failing to protect them from the dangers online.
Thank you, Evgeny, for giving me this opportunity. I'm really interested in what's going on in the UK. I love the UK. As an American, I feel as though I have the cultural inheritance of England and the English-speaking world and the Scottish Enlightenment. And my heart breaks that the Anglo countries, which were the most successful democracies, and they were among the happiest countries, along with the Scandinavians, were all suffering through a similar strange deterioration, which we'll talk about. I'm very excited to talk about that with you. So as for who I am, where I came from, I'm, you know, sort of very stereotypical Jewish American. That is, my grandparents all came here from the old country. My mother's mother was actually born in Bryansk, Russia, and the others from Belarus and Poland. So very typical story of Jewish immigration around 1907 to New York, the garment industry. My parents were born poor, but they worked hard. They were successful. The 20th century was an amazing century for Jews in America. 21st is working out so well, but the 20th century was fantastic. Anyway, I grew up in a suburb of New York City. I was always on the left. I majored in philosophy. I went to graduate school in psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. I did a postdoc research 2 years at the University of Chicago. I went to India and studied culture. My field was morality, moral psychology, and how it varies across cultures. And in the 1990s, as the American culture war began heating up, as left and right began to really hate each other, which wasn't the case before, left and right became like different cultures, you know, almost like, you know, China and Norway. I mean, just like really different beliefs, different U.S. Constitution, different economics textbook, just separating to different worlds. So I started using cultural psychology to study the left-right culture war.
I have asked Jonathan whether his experience of having Jewish heritage in the U.S. has changed since the events of October 7th in Israel.
America has, for my whole life, been philo-Semitic. That is, actually had a very positive opinion of Jews. And on average, that is still true. The average American does. But young Americans feel differently. Black and Latino Americans feel differently. We have ideas of intersectionality that are uniting people against oppressors. And because Jews are successful, they're classed as oppressors. So things change very quickly here, where there is now deep hostility, not just from the traditional anti-Semitic quarters, but from many more points and groups, including especially on the left. So yes, things feel very different now than they did a year ago.
What was the reason for the early polarization?
So there are many, and humans are tribal by nature, and the genius of, I think, Anglo-liberal democracy is it finds ways for us to live together that dampen down the tribalism. So much of the world is suffering from civil wars or inter-ethnic conflict. But written developed ways of living together that create multi-ethnic societies that work peacefully. And then a number of things pull a society apart, but a number pull them together. So just to list some of the changes, losing a common enemy. So when the Soviet Union fell, we lost a common enemy. The media environment changed. It used to be we had three television networks. You know, in the UK, you had the BBC. So everyone got the same information. We had common facts. Now, they might have been tilted to the left somewhat, but at least we had a common set of beliefs. And then as we go from three networks to, you know, five or seven television channels to 500 cable TV channels to 7 billion people, each with their own social media account, or 2 billion, whatever it is, you just get fragmentation. You don't get common knowledge anymore.
But things were still okay, right, until social media arrived on the scene. I mean, they were polarized and they were less collegiate, less agreeable as before that, but still there was dialogue.
There was, but the problems, if you look at polarization in the U.S. Congress, it used to be just elite polarization. It used to be the people aren't very polarized. The people are mostly center-left, center-right, but elites, the Congress, the journalists, they began to get more polarized. And that really begins in the 90s, before social media. And there are a lot of reasons for that. It's not one explanation, but changes in the media environment are definitely a big one. Also changes in generation. The generation that fought World War II all over the world, that generation suffered hardship together and were able to become great citizens who could put aside their differences when it came to foreign policy. And it's just pathetic. It is sad. It is frightening to me now as an American that our leaders can't put aside their differences for foreign policy. So that's very scary from a national security point of view. We can't even pull together when facing foreign adversaries.
So you see, we are tribal barbarians, basically, by nature. And then comes the great Socrates and the schools that follow after, which teach discourse and agreeing to disagree and even better, possibly even changing one's mind upon hearing the right arguments. And there have been ups and downs in that approach throughout history, but post the Enlightenment, as you've mentioned, the Scottish Enlightenment, the institutions of democracy, more or less as we know them now, get created.
So yes, we are tribal by nature. That's the way we lived for hundreds of thousands of years. You might even say millions before there was Homo sapiens. And once we developed agriculture and surpluses, you get civilization in many parts of the world. And some of them continue to be extremely bloody and violent, like the Aztec and Maya civilizations in Central America. You know, they were amazing civilizations that could build pyramids, but they would just cut the hearts out of thousands and thousands of people for their religious rites. On the other hand, you had great civilizations like in China and in the Mediterranean world, in southern India, that developed much more peacefully, less tribally. They had scholars, they had writing and literature. So it's not unique to the West, but what you were tracing out was that the West is different, and that does seem to go back to the philosophical traditions of ancient Greece and Rome. It's also been said that Europe's topography was such that it was harder to have, like, you know, one power dominating the whole thing. And so you had regional powers and lots of rivalry and war, which is a stimulus to innovation and production, yeah, competition. So Europe is unique in many ways. Then the European Enlightenment is unique in many ways. And that was multiple countries. But then you get different models. And so the French model after the revolution was very much a centralized, you know, the government in Paris controls everything. Whereas the British model, I think, was much wiser in being more evolutionary, just recognizing, you know, as with your common law, recognizing you don't just make law from on high and say, here's how it's going to be. Law evolves because life is complicated and we have to develop wisdom slowly. So that's part of, I think, what separates the Anglo societies from, say, continental societies. We have more love of freedom. We have less trust in central government. And at many points in our history, that's been a great way to be.
Jonathan and I are here to talk about social media. We begin by sharing our early impressions of it when it started out in late 2000s.
I remember the excitement about it because I work in the news, and I remember at the time how exciting it was that this will be this unifying factor and everybody will be able to be a journalist and will get incredible stories and it will unite everyone and suddenly the world will become a much better place. But of course, what's happened is the opposite.
What has happened in the past decade or so is that social media has amplified the voices of what used to be the fringe and alienated the more reasonable, middle-of-the-road opinions once held by the majority. Today, that majority is either silent or, in the worst cases, has fractured.
So let me pick up on your point that we're returning to tribalism. So I've recently come across two really, really interesting authors, two really interesting ideas. I recently heard a podcast with Simon Sebag Montefiore, who I believe is a British historian of Russia, in fact.
I know Simon well. He's a very smart man.
Great. So he has a book called, I believe it's called The Great Pause, something like that. The point is that we had a kind of a holiday from history. After World War II, we had just two superpowers. And that was what was very dangerous in terms of nuclear war. It was incredibly stabilizing in terms of suppressing other wars. And then the Soviet Union fell. And then we had a unipolar world where the US was the power, and people might hate us and say that we exploited it. But compared to other powers in history, I think we did a pretty good job of trying to maintain world order and not taking advantage of our power nearly as much as others have in the past. At any rate, the point is that world is now ending. The US is getting less powerful, more fragmented. China and other powers are rising. And so I think Sebag Montefiore's point is, in a sense, that's just the natural state of things. And we had a 70-year period where we were freed from it. But guess what, folks? Holiday's over. History's back. War between competing powers is likely to return. So that's the first thing. Even more interesting to me is a book I've just started recently called The Gutenberg Parenthesis. And the idea is that until Gutenberg, news traveled by word of mouth. There was no standardization. You couldn't know for sure what was true. It was all networks of people. Scribes would write a book, but the books would be different depending on the day the scribe wrote it or the year the scribe spent writing it. And so that's the way things were until Gutenberg. And of course, Gutenberg gets, 1440s. It's not really until the 1500s that you really get the explosion of print. And then you have 200 years in Europe of kind of chaos as the printing press and printed words are having all these amazing effects, later on with the Enlightenment and the scientific revolution, but they're having incredibly destabilizing effects for the kinds of kingdoms that had sprung up. So there's a long transition period.
What's happening in the kingdoms?
So before Gutenberg, empires were based on who you could conquer, and the people that you're conquering don't speak your language generally. And so polylingual, polyglot empires were the norm in the ancient world. It was just about power, who you conquer. But the printing press allowed people to publish, let's say, in German.
I see.
And Germany was all these little tiny things. But once you start publishing in German and they can read it, you get a sense of like a culture zone, like that shares a language. So language becomes more important after Gutenberg. And you have a tribalism based on language, which is related to ethnicity, but not necessarily the same. So the arrival of print changes everything. It also allows for extraordinary stability because you can have written laws, written constitutions. It's not just the rule of a powerful man. But again, going back to Magna Carta, well, that was, written down, the Anglo idea that we need limitations on power, widely agreed on limitations on power, and that allows the society and the economy to flourish. That's, I think, again, part of the magic of the Anglo world was really taking advantage of the print world to create excellent democracies with limited powers. And the point, let me try to remember the author of this important, very interesting book. The point is that, like, the opening parenthesis was, let's say, in the 1500s from print and Gutenberg. And now the closing parenthesis was a period, I think it's the 2010s. Of course, we had the internet before then, but the internet was not as fragmenting and destructive in the 1990s as it became after 2009. You get the like button, the retweet button. Now everything's about virality. Now you have chaos. Now you have rumors spreading within 24 hours. So, again, to your point that we used to be tribal, and then we had this rise of liberal democracy, which suppresses tribalism. Yeah. And now that period is over. The Gutenberg era is closed. We're now in the network era, and we will be for, who knows, centuries, millennia? Who knows? But it's very different. And this is why the Anglo countries are all having trouble together, because terrible, terrible ideas that are created on American college campuses can spread instantly through the English-speaking world, but they don't touch the French world. Because the internet doesn't care about national borders, but it does care about linguistic borders.
So in your view, it's this that straightforward. It's the fact that the ideas that are spread on college campuses in the States originally, I'm guessing, are not spreading to any other campuses apart from the English-speaking ones.
Yes, that's right. So just to give you a case in point, in America, we have our very particular awful history of race, racism, slavery. Many countries had it, but they got rid of it long before we did. They didn't have it as much. So America has a very particular reckoning and struggle with race that we've been working on for since the Civil War, with a lot of progress in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s.
A lot of progress.
So there's a particular American set of ideas that come out of the Jim Crow or the slavery South, in which it really was, racism was written into law, structural racism was there in the law, it was there in custom, and we developed ways of thinking and talking about this and working on it. And this brings us to movements like Black Lives Matter and the idea that everything is racist and everything has to be torn down. Why is this happening in the UK and in Australia? I mean, you obviously have Black and Caribbean and African citizens, but their history in England is very, very different from the African-American story in the United States. Yet our terrible ideas about intersectionality and everything is power and oppression.
Jordan Peterson would say that the American universities are done for, which is why he's setting up his own institution in Vienna.
Ralston, yes.
Do you agree with that? Or do you think there's hope?
Well, you know, what Jordan has gone through, the attacks on him, the fact that he is now treated as radioactive, I certainly understand Jordan's perspective that the universities are done for, they're hopeless, they're beyond repair. I've been working on this intensely since 2015 when I co-founded Heterodox Academy. And if there are any professors, faculty members, or administrators listening to this podcast, I hope you'll go to heterodoxacademy.org and sign up. We're 6,000 professors, mostly professors, who think that we should have viewpoint diversity. We should have, not everyone should be, you know, politically the same on the left. So believe me, I understand Jordan's perspective. My view is that the problems are very deep. The rot is very deep, but there are 4,300 colleges and universities in the United States. And the great majority of them are not having these issues because it's working class kids who want education. They don't want to burn everything down. And even among our top 100 schools, the rot is especially deep at Harvard and in the elite schools in the Northeast and in the University of California system on the West Coast. There's not much of it in the South or the Southwest. So what I see happening is I know that most university presidents hate what's happening. They don't like the shouting down speakers. It makes their job harder. They do believe in free speech and debate, but they've been afraid. They've been very afraid to oppose basically DEI in particular, diversity, equity, and inclusion. The college culture war that began in 2015 was not because people said racist things and then students said you're a racist. It's because professors wrote thoughtful critiques of diversity policies and said, now, wait a second, let's talk about this. I don't think we should be doing, you know, Brett Weinstein said, you know, you're proposing a day in which all whites leave campus. Like, I don't think this is a good thing to do. And that's what caused, well, the riots in some cases, opposing DEI policies. So people learned very quickly, you can never oppose DEI. And Jordan really picked up on that. And he bore the brunt of that because he was very outspoken in opposing DEI. Just to cut to the chase, some schools, like, for example, Arizona State University in the Southwest and the University of Chicago, one of our top universities, they have taken a different path. They have steadfastly defended the importance of letting people talk, of having diverse speakers, and of having consequences for people who shout down visiting speakers. So I think we're going to see a split. I think some schools will follow ASU and Chicago, and other schools will follow Harvard and Yale. And so I think 5 or 10 years from now, people will have a choice. I'm really glad that Jordan is founding Ralston University. I'm on the advisory board of University of Austin, a similar venture to create an alternate university. So I think once we get some choice, once we get a few options for people, I think we're going to see a split.
That was a preview of Brave New World. You can hear the whole show and listen to previous episodes by searching Brave New World Evening Standard in your podcast provider or clicking the link in the show notes.